Welcome back to Introduction to International Politics. This lecture is about trust and exploitation, and we'll develop our third answer to the question of why states sometimes leave money lying on the ground. I should warn you from the outset that this is going to be a long and demanding lecture. It's going to be more technical than the previous lectures. I hope that some of you will also find it to be more insightful, but you should all be aware that this will be challenging to listen to, and if you haven't already gotten in the habit of doing so, it is strongly encouraged that you listen to this lecture multiple times and take very careful notes, particularly because there will be many questions about it on the midterm exam. If you turn to the first slide, I lay out there for you the two goals for this lecture. First, using a game-theoretic model, I will prove that fear of a collaboration problem can prevent cooperation even in the absence of an actual collaboration problem. Second, I will demonstrate empirically that real-world patterns of trade match the expectations of our game-theoretic model. If you turn to the second slide, you find that game-theoretic model. This model is similar in many respects to models you've already seen in this course, but is substantially more complicated, and it's going to take us some time to walk through all the assumptions. First, and simplest, we have two players, one and two, who have two options, as usual. Those options are to allow imports from the other side, or to block them. And if both sides allow imports, then they will be engaging in a fairly high level of trade, and that's what we will mean by cooperation. If neither of them allows imports, if they both choose to block, there will be no trade, and they will each receive a payoff of zero. Where things are going to get more complicated is when we have imbalanced trade, when one state allows imports, but the other does not. Beta here works just like it has in previous models. It is a benefit, and it's a number that's greater than zero. It's known to both players as well. That's going to be important because in this model, unlike any of the models that you've seen since we started talking about cooperation, there's going to be some things that aren't known by both sides. So if they both block, they both get zero, and if they both allow, they both get beta, and beta is bigger than zero. Relatively straightforward so far. However, when player 1 allows imports from 2, and 2 blocks 1's imports, 1 gets a payoff of beta times E1, where E1 stands for exploitation of player 1, and we'll talk more about exactly how that term works in just a minute. And player 2 will receive beta raised to the power of tau 2, where tau 2 stands for the temptation faced by player 2. Similarly, if player 1 blocks imports from 2, player 1 will receive beta raised to the power of tau 1, where tau 1 stands for player 1's temptation. And if player 1 blocks imports from 2, while player 2 allows imports from 1, then player 2 is getting exploited, and player 2's payoff will be beta times E2. So that's the different outcomes that can occur, and the payoffs that are received at the different outcomes. Let's talk now about how these terms actually work. So first, it's important to note that player I, and I use I here generically to mean either 1 or 2, knows the value of the actual numeric quantity that is assigned to the more general variable that you see represented before you on the screen, of beta, EI, EJ, that is the exploitation value for the other player, J here simply means not I, and tau I. That is, I am using general placeholder terms in the model, but the players in the game know the actual numerical value of beta, their own exploitation term, the other side's exploitation term, and their own temptation. Obviously, what this implies is they do not know the other player's temptation. I'll tell you what they do know about the other player's temptation, because they can make educated guesses, in just a few minutes. Moving to the second bullet point, as I've already said, beta is a positive number, but the E's are not necessarily positive. The exploitation parameters range from -1, inclusive, to +1, not inclusive. And what that means is, when we multiply beta times an exploitation term, we're going to end up with a quantity that is strictly less than beta, and potentially even negative. If you think back to the lecture on money left lying on the ground, I made the argument that states as a whole, setting aside for now the issue of winners and losers within each country, states as a whole are made better off when they specialize in producing things where they have a comparative advantage and then trade with one another. I also argued that there is no economic basis for being terribly concerned about imbalanced trade, because that would be the equivalent of assuming that whenever you as an individual go out and buy anything at all, you're strictly made worse off because you have bought something. That's the attitude that some people have about imports. However, in this model, I'm going to allow for the possibility that states are made off by allowing imports, particularly if they're allowing imports in from a country that does not accept imports from them. In other words, I think that we as observers of international politics need to take seriously the possibility that politically motivated actors will view imports as potentially damaging, particularly when trade is imbalanced, for political reasons, even if there isn't a sound economic basis for opposing imbalanced trade. In other words, what I'm basically saying is, economists may write op-eds saying, hey, we shouldn't be so worried about those scary foreigners who aren't buying our stuff and who are flooding our market with cheap goods, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everyone always believes that. And because I'm aware that people don't always believe that, I'm going to develop a game theoretic model where I don't assume that it's always the case that states value outcomes where they are importing from countries who won't accept their imports more than they do no trade at all. Neither, however, do I assume that they're always made worse off. I'm just going to allow the E terms to range from negative quantities to positive quantities. Sometimes it will be the case that imbalanced trade is better than no trade. Sometimes it won't be. Moving on to the taus, where things get even more complicated. Each player knows that the other side comes in two different varieties or types, to use more common jargon. So player I knows that player J is either blue or red, and player J knows that player I is either blue or red. And each player knows that the probability that the other player is blue is phi, where phi is just some probability. And the probability that the other player is red is 1 minus phi. And when the other side is blue, that means their temptation term, the tau, is relatively small and represented by tau underline. When they're red, they have a larger temptation, which is represented by tau overline. And recall, tau is an exponent that we raise beta to when a player blocks imports from the other side, but the other side allows their imports in. So that's why it's the temptation value. It's how much better off you are if you exploit the other player. The blue types of 1 and 2 are made better off when they exploit the other player, as opposed to what happens when we have a more balanced cooperative outcome. But they're not made better off to the same degree as the red types. So the red types we can think of as being meaner and more selfish because they face a higher temptation. But it's important to note that even the blue types will potentially face that temptation, as long as tau is a number that's greater than 1. And I haven't said that anything about the size of tau underline relative to 1. All I have said on that bottom bullet point is that both taus are positive, and that tau underline is strictly less than tau overline. We will talk about what happens in situations where both taus are below 1. We'll talk about what happens in situations where both taus are above 1. And we'll talk about what happens in situations where the red tau, tau overline, is above 1, but the blue one, tau underline, is not. So just to recap before we move forward, I know that's a lot of information. We have two players who are deciding whether to allow imports into their country or not. If both choose to do so, if they cooperate with one another, they each receive some benefit, and everyone's happy, and it's relatively similar to what we've talked about before. If neither allows imports, if they both choose to block, no one gets any benefit. If one side allows imports and the other does not, the player who is allowing imports is said to have been exploited, and their payoff may be negative. It may be positive, but even if it's positive, it's not going to be as good as beta. So they're definitely worse off than they could have been, and they may be worse off even than if there was no trade at all. The player who does the exploiting, who's receiving their temptation payoff, is going to be potentially better off than they would be under balance trade, and is certainly better off than they would be with no trade. And the way that we see this is by looking at the tau terms, and we're raising beta to the power of tau. If tau is less than 1, then that's actually making beta smaller, so it's not as good as full cooperation, but it's still certainly better than 0. If tau is greater than 1, then the player is strictly better off than even the cooperative outcome, which cannot happen when they've been exploited. Players who are exploited may or may not be worse off than no trade, but they're certainly worse off than balanced trade. Incidentally, when I refer to tau without specifying under or over or 1 or 2, I'm using the generic version, but tau 1, tau 2, tau 1 underline, tau 2 underline, tau 1 overline, tau 2 overline, tau I underline and overline, tau j underline and overline are all different versions of the more generic tau. So when I say tau, I just mean any of those specific versions. When I say e, I mean any of the specific versions. When I say I, that's just a generic version that could be contrasted with j, which is not I. Okay, if you haven't already gotten familiar with the terminology, you might want to stop at this point, rewind, and re-listen to that part of the lecture, because it's going to be very hard to follow everything from this point forward if you're not comfortable with these symbols. So again, beta is the benefit that's received from trade. Beta is multiplied by some exploitation term E when a player allows imports from a country that does not allow their imports. Beta is raised to the power of tau when one country exploits the other, and the players receive no utility when there's no trade. Okay, so hopefully you're comfortable with the notation now. Let's move forward. On the third slide, I discuss, without getting into too much detail, some trivial equilibria. That is, I want to acknowledge that there are things that can happen other than what we're going to focus on before I get to the results that I want to draw your attention to. First of all, there does exist an equilibrium where the probability of cooperation is precisely 0. That is, where it is absolutely a foregone conclusion that they will not reach the outcome of allow. This is the only equilibrium to the game when even the lower temptation values for both players are greater than 1. And another way to think about that is, when even tau 1 underline and tau 2 underline are greater than 1, when even the blue types are pretty nasty, everyone knows that there is a collaboration problem, and so there will be no cooperation for precisely the same reason that there was no cooperation in the arms race game that we discussed in the lecture on collaboration problems. There also, however, exists an equilibrium where the probability of cooperation is precisely 1.0, where it's a foregone conclusion that the outcome of the game will be allow. That is the only equilibrium to this game when both tau 1 overline and tau 2 overline are less than 1, and where the exploitation terms are both negative. In these situations, everyone knows for an absolute certainty that there is not a collaboration problem. And in fact, neither side can be made better off by deviating from the cooperative outcome, nor is block-block an equilibrium. And so when even the quote-unquote nasty types, the red types, actually have no temptation whatsoever to exploit the other side, and when getting exploited is so bad that being able to exploit somebody makes you worse off than having no trade at all, then the only outcome that we expect to occur is allow-allow, the cooperative outcome. And that's good. So I want to acknowledge that the assumptions that I made on the previous slide allow for these possibilities, and there's no reason to doubt that these possibilities do in fact occur at times in the real world. But we're now going to turn our attention to the more interesting case where the blue type is kind of nice and doesn't face any real temptation to exploit the other side, but the red type is not so nice and does face real temptation to exploit the other side. That is, I want to talk about situations where trust is not a trivial issue, because you know that it's possible that the other side wants to exploit you. You also know it's possible that they don't want to exploit you, and you don't know for sure who you're dealing with. So I now want to discuss what I'm calling the conditionally cooperative equilibrium. In this most interesting equilibrium to the model, each state allows imports from the other side if and only if they themselves happen to be the blue type. That is, the red type of player 1 and the red type of player 2 come to the table fully intending to block imports. The blue type of player 1 and the blue type of player 2 come to the table fully intending to allow imports. Is that if either player is red, we will not get cooperation. In this situation, again, we're assuming that the blue types are relatively nice, and by that I mean their taus are lower than 1. We could also describe that as saying that they are trustworthy. Whereas the red types are not so nice, their taus are greater than 1, and they are not trustworthy. And when it's the case that the blue types are trustworthy and the red types are not trustworthy, that is, the blue types have no temptation to exploit the other player, but the red types do, then if either of the players happens to be their red type, then we won't get cooperation because they will exploit the other player if they get the chance to do so. So that's relatively straightforward and relatively unsurprising, I hope. What's a little bit more surprising, perhaps, is that the model is telling us that it's possible for both sides to be blue in situations where being blue means having a low temptation, having no desire to exploit the other player, and yet for cooperation to fail. Under the conditionally cooperative equilibrium, if both sides are blue, we get cooperation. But the conditionally cooperative equilibrium is not the only equilibrium that occurs when blue types are trustworthy and red types are not. We'll see this more clearly after we go through the proof on the next slide, but I'm just trying to establish for now that the conditionally cooperative equilibrium requires both sides to trust one another. It is not sufficient for them to both be trustworthy. They both have to be pretty confident that the other side is trustworthy. If it happens to be the case that they are both blue, but they are afraid that the other side might not be blue with sufficiently high probability, they will not cooperate. And that's what I meant at the start of the lecture when I said fear of a collaboration problem can prevent cooperation even when no collaboration problem actually exists. If both types are trustworthy, if they both have taus that are below 1, indicating that they wouldn't even profit from exploitation and would be more than happy to remain at the outcome of allow-allow, they may nonetheless fail to cooperate because they don't know that about each other, and they may be unwilling to risk getting exploited by somebody who, unbeknownst to them, never would have chosen to exploit them. So that's a different explanation for leaving money on the ground than either coordination problems or collaboration problems, though clearly we can't understand this explanation for failing to cooperate very well until we first understand collaboration problems. Okay, So having established what the conditionally cooperative equilibrium tells us in terms of who will cooperate and when we should expect cooperation overall, I want to point out that we can already say a bit more about when cooperation occurs by assigning precise probabilities to the different possible outcomes. That is, under the conditionally cooperative equilibrium, the probability of cooperation is precisely phi1 times phi2. And the reason for that is, under the conditionally cooperative equilibrium, we get cooperation if and only if both players are their blue types, and the probability that player 1 is blue is phi1, and the probability that player 2 is blue is phi2, and so the joint probability of them both being blue is simply phi1 times phi2. Incidentally, the probability that player 1 gets exploited is phi1 times 1 minus phi2, because player 1 gets exploited when player 1 is willing to cooperate and player 2 is not. And that happens when player 1 is blue, but player 2 is red. The probability that player 2 gets exploited is 1 minus phi1 times phi2, for a similar reason. And the probability that nobody allows imports, that we see no trade, is 1 minus phi1 times 1 minus phi2, because if both players are red, then nobody's going to allow imports, and we're not going to see any trade. So that's the basics of the equilibrium and what it implies we should expect from each type of each player. Let's now walk through when this equilibrium will hold. There's one key condition in general form, although we can actually use this analysis to establish the behavior of each type of each player. So when you answer questions on the homework, you're going to have to work with the inequality that you see on the screen here on the fifth slide four different times, once each for the blue and red type of player 1 and player 2. But here I'm just giving you the generic version. So player I, which can be either 1 or 2, depending on which one you're focusing on for the homework or for the exam or whatever, player I allows imports from player J if and only if the expected utility received by I when allowing is at least as large as the expected utility enjoyed by I when blocking. And using the formula for expected utility discussed earlier in the course, and the payoffs given to you on a previous slide of this lecture, we can establish that the expected utility to player I of allowing imports is phi j, the probability that player j is blue, times beta, the benefit that's received when both players allow imports, plus 1 minus phi j, the probability that player j is red and will try to exploit I, multiplied by beta I, the payoff that player I gets when player I is in fact exploited by player j. On the right-hand side of the inequality, we have phi j times beta raised to the tau I, where tau I would be either tau underline I or tau overline I, depending on which type of I we're actually dealing with, plus 1 minus phi j times 0. And the reason the right-hand side looks that way is because if we're in the conditionally cooperative equilibrium, where blue types allow and red types do not, and player I chooses to block, then when they wind up facing the blue type of player J, they're going to exploit J, and they're going to get their temptation payoff. When, however, it turns out that J is red, then neither player will have allowed imports, they will have both blocked, and player I will receive a zero. So, as always, we take the payoff that is received at each of the possible outcomes and multiply it by its respective probability of occurring and add all of that together. That's what I've done on both sides of this inequality. Moving from that bullet point down to the one below it, all I've done is eliminate things in parentheses by multiplying things out and dropping out the term that just goes to zero. So phi j parentheses beta becomes phi j beta, 1 minus phi j beta ei becomes beta ei minus phi j beta ei. And on the right-hand side, phi j parentheses beta tau I becomes phi j beta tau I. And 1 minus phi j times 0 becomes 0, and we just drop it out altogether. Moving to the next bullet point, I've moved things around so that everything that's got a phi j on it is together, because we're going to be able to take advantage of that to summarize the results in a slightly neater form in a few minutes by doing so. So the next step is to just factor out the phi j from the three pieces that have a phi j in it, so that we're rewriting the right-hand side as phi j parentheses beta tau I minus beta plus beta ei instead of phi j times beta tau I minus phi j beta plus phi j beta ei. And once we've done that, we can divide both sides of the inequality by the stuff in parentheses, and that's going to allow us to say that player I will allow imports from j if and only if phi j is less than or equal to phi j hat when the denominator of the previous inequality is positive, and when phi j is greater than or equal to phi j hat when that denominator is negative. That is, if we divide by a negative quantity, we have to flip the sign of the inequality. But provided that the denominator is positive, then all we've done is created a new term, phi j hat, that stands for what's left after we've divided beta ei by the stuff in parentheses, and twirled the inequality around so that we have phi j on the left-hand side instead of the right-hand side. So phi j hat, by definition, is equivalent to the fraction that's left when we have beta ei divided by the stuff that was in parentheses being multiplied by phi j a couple of bullet points up. And we're now saying that we've got this quantity, phi j hat, and comparing phi j to it tells us what player I will do. That is, phi j hat is a new term I'm creating right now, and its sole purpose for existing is that when we compare phi j to it, we can tell what player I will do. If the denominator of phi j hat is positive, then we want to ask, is phi j less than or equal to phi j hat? And if it is, then player I will allow imports from j. If the denominator of phi j hat is negative, then we compare phi j to it and ask whether it's greater than phi j hat, and if it is, player I will allow imports from j. Incidentally, it's worth noting here that because phi j is literally the probability that player j is blue, and because under the conditionally cooperative equilibrium, being blue means being trustworthy, we can interpret phi j as the probability that j is trustworthy, which we can also then think of as how much I trusts j. If phi j is how trustworthy j is, then it's reasonable to assume that that's precisely how much trust I has in j. In other words, we're going to assume that players trust those who they think are likely to be trustworthy to a greater degree than they trust those who they think are unlikely to be trustworthy. So what we've said with this slide is, if we want to know whether I will allow imports from J, we have to know how much I trusts J, which is given to us by phi J, and we need to compare that to phi J hat, which is a quantity that exists solely for the purpose of allowing us to figure out what I will do by comparing phi j to it. Sometimes we want phi j to be less than or equal to phi j hat, which is another way of saying I is more likely to cooperate, to allow imports, when I does not trust j very much. But sometimes we want phi j to be greater than phi j hat, which means I is more likely to allow imports when I trust j more rather than less. Whether it's higher or lower levels of trust that lead to I being more likely to allow imports from j depends on whether the denominator of phi j hat is negative. So, to recap, the conditionally cooperative equilibrium, which we can refer to as CCE for short, holds when the relevant inequalities are satisfied for the blue type of each side, because I said on the previous slide that under the conditionally cooperative equilibrium, the blue types will allow imports. But when the relevant inequalities taken from this slide do not hold for the red types, because I said on the previous slide that the red types do not allow imports. So I've written one set of conditions using very generic language, but when we want to know whether the equilibrium holds, we have to figure out whether phi j is less than or equal to, or greater than or equal to, depending on which one is appropriate, phi j hat, using a different value of phi j hat for each type of j, and then we need to do the same for I. So we need to check four different conditions, like I said earlier. Okay, now let's move forward and talk about some of the implications of this model and the equilibria that we've established. What we've gone over so far are the details of what's possible in this model, the assumptions of the model, and when we expect different things to occur. I now want to transition and talk about what the model tells us we ought to expect when we go and look at the real world, as we're going to do in just a minute. You should be familiar with the details. You should be comfortable with the notation because you will be asked questions about it on the homework and the exam. But from this point forward, I want to start getting more practical and less technical and less theoretical. So one thing that the model tells us is that trust only sometimes promotes cooperation. I want to be careful here, though, because the previous slide might have given you a false impression. It actually turns out, and you can prove this to yourself by plugging in numbers, that when the conditionally cooperative equilibrium is requiring a relatively low level of trust, when it's requiring phi j to be less than or equal to phi hat, as opposed to greater than or equal to it, that's only going to be the case when it just so happens that phi j hat is a number greater than 1. And what that's telling us is it's actually an absolute certainty that I will allow imports, because what the condition that sustains the equilibrium amounts to is I will allow imports from J as long as I's trust in J is not greater than some number that is itself greater than 1, and probabilities can't exceed 1. So if we're saying the only way I wouldn't cooperate, wouldn't allow imports, is if their level of trust in J exceeded 300%, then that's a nonsense condition. So yes, it's technically true that the model says that sometimes there is such a thing as too much trust, but those conditions are sort of silly and they never really wind up having any practical implication. So in other words, when it says on this slide that trust only sometimes promotes cooperation, that does not mean that trust sometimes prevents cooperation. It means that sometimes trust is irrelevant to cooperation because cooperation is already going to occur, even if the players do not trust each other very much. So when we get to the application of the model to real-world patterns of trade, what we're going to be looking to see is that trust is sometimes very important, but sometimes not important because cooperation is already very likely. And we can prove using calculus, so I won't do that because some of you would have difficulty following along, but you will prove for yourself in a less rigorous way in the homework assignment that trust is more likely to be important to cooperation when the stakes are low. And by the stakes, I mean beta, the potential benefit of cooperation. In other words, when cooperation is extremely attractive, 1 and 2 are likely to cooperate irrespective of how much they trust one another. When the benefits of cooperation are more modest, they will potentially still be willing to cooperate with one another, but only if they trust one another enough. That's, again, why I'm saying trust only sometimes promotes cooperation. There's never a situation where more trust is a bad thing, practically speaking, because It can happen theoretically, but only under nonsense conditions. Trust never inhibits cooperation, but is sometimes unnecessary for cooperation, and that's particularly likely to be the case when the benefits from cooperating are very high. We should also note that cooperation is more likely to occur irrespective of the stakes and irrespective of the levels of trust the two states have in one another when relations are harmonious. And what I mean by harmonious here, I'm just trying to save space on the slide, is that there's relatively low temptations for both sides, and they wouldn't feel particularly harmed if exploited. That is, that the taus are below one, or close to one in the case of the red types, and the e's are positive. And the way to think about what this means in practical terms is situations where opening yourself up to trade, specializing in producing goods where you have a comparative advantage, is not going to mean putting an entire industry out of work and therefore having lots of workers angry at the government. And I think that that's most likely to occur, based on a lot of work in economics, when the two countries have very similarly structured economies. That is, if you have two countries with very different levels of economic development, one being very high in skilled workers and having an abundance of capital, and the other having a lot of unskilled workers and very little capital, then the areas where they will have comparative advantages are very different. And when they trade with one another, the country that is producing a good at a very low cost that the other country used to produce for itself but at a high cost is going to put the workers that were being paid high salaries to produce a good inefficiently out of work, and that's going to create problems politically in one of the countries, or potentially both. That's unlikely to happen when the two countries have such similarly structured economies that they have similar comparative advantages, and what they're really doing when they trade is just exchanging different versions of the same good. So, for example, the United States and Germany have relatively similarly structured economies, and both are leading producers of high-tech manufactured goods, including automobiles. And the United States imports a lot of German automobiles, and Germany imports a fair amount of American automobiles. And it's not because they are selling each other completely equivalent products, is that they have relatively similar comparative advantages, but they differentiate their products by making slightly different versions thereof. In other words, Americans buy German luxury sedans. They don't buy German sport utility vehicles. Germans buy American sport utility vehicles and not luxury sedans. Similarly, the U.S. and Japan do a fair amount of trade in automobiles, and when the United States is buying automobiles from Japan, it's not generally buying pickup trucks. So when I say harmonious, that's just a shorthanded way for saying that the two countries have similarly structured economies, and because they have similarly structured economies, we're not going to see major industries in country one putting major industries in country two out of work when the two open up their countries to imports from the other side. If they have very dissimilar economies, then it is more likely to be the case that they're producing fundamentally different goods, and an entire industry is going to be put out of work when the two begin trading. And so that would not be harmonious relations, it would be more adversarial. So when we go and look at real-world patterns of trade, as we're about to do, there are three things that we're looking for. One is that trust is sometimes helpful for cooperation, and sometimes unnecessary, but never hurtful. One is that it's particularly going to be the case that trust is helpful for cooperation when the stakes are low. That is, where the overall benefit to be gained isn't very big. And the third thing that we're going to be looking for is that cooperation is always more likely to occur at any level of stakes and any level of trust when relations are harmonious, by which we mean that the countries have similarly structured economies and therefore won't be putting entire industries out of work, but will be differentiating their products and trading the same goods and keeping people employed in the same industries, but making slightly different versions of everything. Okay, now would be a good time to take a break. Listen to everything you've listened to again, review your notes, make sure you're comfortable with the notation, make sure you understand the different equilibria and the conditions that sustain the conditionally cooperative equilibria, because you're going to be asked a fair amount of detailed technical questions on the homework assignment and the midterm. But if you're comfortable with everything that we've covered so far, now we're going to move forward and talk about whether we see the patterns anticipated by the theoretical model when we look at trade between real countries in the real world. So the seventh slide describes for you the data used in the statistical analysis. Let's first just talk about which observations are included before I describe the variables. The data set includes all dyad years from 1870 to 1913, and then from 1950 to 2005. We don't include any observations from World War I, World War II, or the period between World War II, mostly because the data aren't available, but also because we'd probably be seeing slightly different patterns that could really complicate things. So we've got data where available. The data sets I'm drawing upon, coming from the Correlates of War Project, only record levels of trade going back to 1870. We've got data where available from 1870 up to just before World War I, and then starting a couple years after World War II, running up to the most recent year in which the trade data are available. Incidentally, dyad year is a term that refers to a type of unit of observation. A dyad year is different than a dyad. A dyad consists of a pair of states. So the U.S. and Canada comprise a dyad. The U.S. and Canada in 1870 comprise a unique dyad year, which is distinct from the U.S. and Canada in 1871, or the U.S. and Canada in 2005, and so forth. So each row in the data set, that's what I mean by observation, consists of the experience of a different pair of countries in a different year. For every pair of countries in every year from 1870 to 1913, and then again from 1950 to 2005. So there are a large number of observations in this data set, over 600,000 as it turns out. And so for each of these 600,000 plus observations, I have a dependent variable and a number of independent variables that I use to try and explain variation in the dependent variable. And the dependent variable, the thing we seek to explain, is a binary measure of whether the trade relations between the two countries in that particular year were cooperative. This is measured in what is admittedly a relatively arbitrary way, but I should stress that I have also checked to see whether the patterns I'm about to show you are essentially the same if we measure things differently, and they pretty much are. So if you're uncomfortable with the way I'm choosing to define cooperative trade relations here, rest assured that we'd see essentially the same thing, slightly different in the magnitudes and the precise details, but essentially the same pattern if we measured things a little bit differently. So this binary dependent variable is equal to 1, indicating that that dyad in that year was cooperating in respect to trade, if and only if three conditions are met. And all three of those conditions are met simultaneously in approximately 35% of my 600,000 plus observations. So we're setting a threshold for determining that cooperation has occurred that's demanding enough that most of the time we aren't observing cooperation, but it's not extremely demanding, and we're not setting the bar so high that very few pairs of countries ever pass it. The first condition is that imports from country 1 to country 2 exceeded $10 million as measured by the current value of US dollars in the year in question. The second condition is that the same is true in the other direction. incidentally, that's a relatively high level of trade, historically speaking, for some countries, but not very high. There are relatively few countries that have trade with one another that does not exceed this amount. So we're throwing away pairs of countries that have very, very minimal trade ties with one another, and those that have no trade ties with one another. But most countries that have imports back and forth are going to meet the first two criteria. The third one is going to lose a fair number of cases, and I think this one is pretty important. And this third criteria is that the larger flow is less than 75% of the total trade volume. That is, the imports from one to two, if one is doing more importing than two, cannot constitute more than 75% of the total imports between one and two. If that is the case, then I think what we're looking at is imbalanced trade that's potentially exploitative in nature. And so we don't want to count towards the assessment of predictions about cooperation cases where we're not really seeing what the theoretical model thought of as cooperation. So the dependent variable is equal to 1, indicating that cooperation occurred, if and only if the two sides trade with one another in a non-trivial way and their trade ties are relatively balanced. This is allowing for a certain amount of inequality, but nothing too extreme. If they either don't trade with each other very much or they're trading in a way that's imbalanced and potentially exploitative, then we're going to say they're not cooperating and the dependent variable will be assigned a value of 0. Now let's talk about the independent variables, the things that we're going to use to attempt to explain the difference between those who cooperate with their trade relations and those who do not. First, I have a variable that is intended to proxy for trust with the phi terms in the theoretical model we're measuring. And trust here is measured in an admittedly crude and indirect way with a binary variable that takes on a value of 1 if and only if country 1 has an embassy in country 2 and country 2 has an embassy in 1. That is, if they have fairly high levels of diplomatic cooperation with one another, I'm going to take that as a sign that they trust one another, or perhaps even something that might be leading to higher levels of trust since they're going to be able to communicate frequently. So regardless of whether you want to interpret that as they wouldn't have embassies if they didn't already trust one another, or the fact that they have embassies is going to make it easier to trust one another, it should either way be true that countries that have embassies with one another are going to trust one another at a higher rate than countries that do not have embassies on both sides. And so we should expect to see that the things that the model says occur more often at higher levels of trust should occur more often between pairs of states that have embassies on each side. So again, it's not a perfect measure. It isn't literally phi, but we should expect that the things that the model says occur more often when phi is higher should occur more often when the variable that I'm here calling trust but really represents that they share embassies in each other's countries is taking on a value of 1. I have a crude measure of whether relations are harmonious, which I think fits onto the theoretical concept perhaps a little bit better based on what I was saying a few minutes ago. And this is based on how different their energy consumption levels are. So again, the argument I made before is that harmonious relations are going to occur when opening up your country to imports from the other country isn't going to have an entire industry getting laid off. And that's likely to be true if you have similarly structured economies. It's unlikely to be true if you have very different comparative advantages and your entire auto sector is going to go out of business when you start trading with the other country. And so the way I measure that is the energy consumption per capita in the country that has the lower level of energy consumption per capita out of the two divided by the total amount of energy consumption per capita between the two countries. So that's going to be a number that I've rescaled to go from 0 to 1, but as written literally on the screen, would go from 0 to 0.5. And at 0.5, the lower of the two has exactly half of what they both have collectively, of the total amount. And that would mean they have very, very similarly structured economies because they have identical levels of energy consumption per capita. So what would have been 0.5 before I adjusted it, but is going to be 1.0 when I rescale things just to make it slightly more intuitive, simply represents that the two countries have identical levels of energy consumption, and that means that they're similar in their levels of economic development. When harmonious takes on values closer to zero, that means that the country with the lower amount of energy consumption per capita in this dyad has a very low level of energy consumption per capita relative to the total amount in the dyad, and that's indicating that they have very differently structured economies because one of them is very highly developed and one of them is not very highly developed. And that would be the type of situation where they would have very different comparative advantages, and engaging in trade is going to put entire industries out of work in one or both countries. Finally, the stakes variable, which is also pretty crude, but I think will in fact take on higher values in situations where the true beta term, if we could measure directly, would take on larger values, is a function of the population of each country and how far apart they are geographically. So the assumption here is simply that there's more potential for benefit from trade between large countries that are geographically close to one another than there is when one country is very small, the other country is very small, and they're both very far apart. Countries that are small and far apart don't stand to produce a very large dollar amount of trade between the two of them because they're small economies to begin with, and the shipping costs of getting stuff from one country to the other might be prohibitively high. So I'm measuring stakes, and again, this is not a literal direct measure of beta, it's just a variable that I'm comfortable assuming will on average take on higher values in situations where what we would like to measure directly if we could would in fact take on higher values, is going to be equal to population 1 times population 2 over the natural log of the distance between the countries. The precise details there aren't important. The intuition is this is a variable that will take on large values when we have two big countries that are right next to each other, and will take on very small values when we have very small countries that are very far apart from one another, and will take on intermediate values when we have one large country, one small country, and they're moderately far away from one another. So just to recap, we're looking at the experiences of all pairs of countries between 1870 and 1913 and between 1950 and 2005. And what we're asking is, did they trade with one another at a relatively high rate and in a relatively balanced way? And to try and explain whether that happened or not, we're going to look at their diplomatic relations, assuming that that proxies for how much trust they have in one another. The structure of their economies relative to one another, with the assumption that if they're both highly developed or both very lowly developed, that there's not going to be so much potential for entire industries being put out of work when they start trading with one another. And finally, that the overall potential for benefit in monetary terms is going to be greater when we have large countries that are close to one another, smaller when we have small countries far apart from one another, and somewhere in the middle the rest of the time. Okay, on the eighth slide, what you see is just a snapshot of the data that I'm providing, as I have provided pictures of spreadsheets before, just to help you picture in your mind what data sets actually look like, because it's my experience that most undergraduates do not have an easy time doing that. So what you see here is just a small piece of the very large data set, and this is telling us the information for the US and Canada between 1971 and 2005. The C code variables are just identifying variables. They're not actually included in the analysis. It's providing numerical scores to the two countries in ways that have important statistical properties that are not very interesting for this class. But if you're wondering what C code 1 means, if you see C code 1 equal to 2, that means we're talking about the United States. If you see C code 2 equal to 20, that means we're talking about Canada. Year is straightforward. 1971 means 1971. Distance is the number of kilometers between D.C. and Canada. I'm sorry, D.C. and Ottawa, the capital of Canada, and that obviously does not vary from year to year. Flow 1 is the overall amount of imports from Canada into the U.S. Flow 2 is the total amount of imports from the U.S. into Canada. Trust is equal to 1 in all of the years that you see in front of you, because it was true in all of the years that you see in front of you that the U.S. had an embassy in Canada and Canada had an embassy in the U.S. The energy consumption levels are then provided, Consump 1 being the energy consumption per capita of the United States, Consump 2 being the energy consumption per capita of Canada, Harmon being the variable that represents how much of the total energy consumption per capita the smaller number consists of. And again, I've rescaled that to go from 0 to 1 just to make it a little more intuitive. And as you can see, in every year that we're looking at, that's very close to 1, because the U.S. and Canada are both very highly developed economically and they're very similarly structured economies. Co-op, the measure of cooperation, is equal to 1 in all the years we're looking at, because the U.S. and Canada had a very substantial amount of trade that was relatively evenly balanced in all of the years that we're looking at. Stakes is not so easy to interpret, because you'd have to look at other observations to know what low or high stakes are in relative terms. But that, like I said in the previous slide, is population 1 times population 2 divided by the natural log of the distance between their capital cities. And so the actual numbers that you're looking at for the actual observations for the U.S. and Canada between 1971 and 2005 are not particularly interesting. I just wanted you to look at a snapshot of the data to get more comfortable thinking about observations and variables and how that actually plays out. What's more important, what I'd like you to really focus on, what you'll be asked questions about on the second homework assignment on the midterm, is the 9th slide, where I'm showing you the results of the analysis, which again includes all diet years from 1870 to 1913 and 1950 to 2005, not just the U.S. and Canada. What you see here on this graph is the x-axis measures the stakes, as defined on the previous slides. The y-axis is the estimated probability of cooperation obtained from my statistical analysis of all dyad years from 1870 and so on. And the blue lines are those predictions when trust levels are high. The red lines are those predictions when trust levels are low. The dotted lines are the confidence intervals that take into account how much uncertainty there is around our estimates, because in statistics you're always a little bit uncertain. You don't know for sure whether you've got the right answer. But in this case, we see those confidence intervals are pretty tightly clustered around the predictions. And the solid lines represent adversarial relations, with the dashed lines representing harmonious relations. So you've got four lines here telling you the predicted probability of cooperation at any given level of stakes for pairs of countries that have harmonious relations and high trust, that is, similarly structured economies and joint embassies, adversarial relations but high trust, differently structured economies but each side is represented by an embassy in the other country, harmonious relations but low trust, similarly structured economies but no diplomatic ties of that particular form, which means they might have a charge of affairs but not a full embassy, and adversarial ties with low trust. So different structure to the economy for each state, and they do not each have embassies. So again, we're looking at the probability of cooperation at any given level of stakes for four different situations where they have similarly structured economies and diplomatic ties that would indicate a high level of trust, when they have different structures to their economies but they do have diplomatic ties that indicate a high level of trust, when they have similar economies but do not have diplomatic ties that would indicate trust, and when they have different economies and do not have diplomatic ties. And what we're seeing here, as expected according to the theoretical model, is that low levels of stakes, both of the blue lines are very far apart from the red lines. They're significantly higher. there is a higher probability of cooperation when trust is high than when trust is low. If you compare harmonious to harmonious, we see that at the lowest levels of stakes, the probability of cooperation is approximately 0.5 if there's high trust, and approximately 0.05 if there's low trust. So there's an increase in 45 percentage points of the likelihood of cooperation when we go from the low level of trust to the high level of trust when the stakes are low. Similarly, if we compare adversarial relations, we go from a probability of cooperation of about 3.3 to a probability of about 0.03 when we move from a high level of trust to a low level of trust. That's not quite as dramatic, but still a pretty big jump. Move all the way to the right, though, where the stakes are high, and you can see that trust no longer matters. The blue harmonious line and the red harmonious line are almost exactly the same at the very far right of the graph. And the confidence intervals, in fact, overlap. So taking into account that there's a little bit of uncertainty around our predictions, we basically should say that the probability of cooperation for countries that have harmonious relations at high levels of stakes is the exact same whether they have high levels of trust or low levels of trust. And for adversarial relations, the predictions are the exact same. We don't even have to take the confidence intervals into account. It is precisely the prediction of this model that when the stakes are very, very high between pairs of countries with adversarial relations, that is, very different levels of economic development as indicated by energy consumption per capita, the probability of cooperation has nothing at all to do with trust. So, again, as expected by the theoretical model, when the stakes are low, trust matters a lot. When the stakes are high, trust doesn't matter at all. Nowhere on this graph do we see too much trust preventing cooperation, nor should we have expected to see that, as discussed earlier in the lecture. But we are seeing that cooperation is only sometimes important. It's never a bad thing, but it really only helps us get to cooperation that wasn't already going to occur when the stakes are low. We're also seeing that harmonious relations promote cooperation irrespective of the level of trust and irrespective of the stakes. And so all of the major observable implications that followed from our theoretical model are borne out when we look at actual trade relations between actual countries in the real world. And so we don't know for sure that the model is quote-unquote right. In fact, no model is, as we discussed earlier in the course when we talked about science of simplification. But in this model, where we treated states as unitary actors, where we sort of waved our hands at domestic politics a little bit, but didn't get into too much detail on how things going on within the country are going to influence their behavior. We didn't say a word about norms or culture or international institutions. We made some very, very strong and simple assumptions about how the world works, and we pretended there are only two countries that exist at a time, and we drew from that highly stylized theoretical model a couple of strong predictions that seem to be consistent with what has actually happened in the real world. And so that's pretty neat. This doesn't tell us everything there is to know about trade, but we're seeing some patterns that the model told us we should expect to see that we might not have considered obvious without the theoretical model, and suggests that actual real-world politics, particularly when it comes to trade, plays out in a manner that's similar to the primary predictions of the simple theoretical model that I took you through earlier. Thank you, and that concludes this lecture.